What's up, folks? This is Archaic Wrestling, a wrestling history podcast. My name is Evan, and I'm joined, as always, with Sasha.
Hello, everybody.
Sasha, it's good to see you. There's been a little bit of stuff happening in the wrestling world since we last spoke, or well, since we last did a podcast, at least. We talk a little bit more often than that. But biggest things are the results of Final X, and maybe even more to say about the other topic, which is just the brand new rules for college wrestling. And I'm excited about both of these things. But first, wanted to give you space if you want to say anything about Final X, your reactions to it, your takeaways.
Vito looked incredible. That was really interesting. It was really interesting seeing David Taylor and Brooks. That was a match. Anytime you have, you know, two Penn Staters going at it, it's interesting. There's a level of like, you wouldn't think anyone else could beat Taylor or that it would even be close. So it was interesting to see. I didn't think Brooks would beat him, but it was definitely a match I was like keyed into.
Yeah, I didn't think Brooks was going to be able to last with him. He wouldn't be able to keep up with him down the line. That was kind of how I felt about it. And Vito, the most exciting wrestler for me to watch right now. Like, I want to watch every Vito match because he is just so on point. He's electric to see right now. He's scoring points from everywhere. He feels like he's really begun to understand like how he can use his body and his style. Like, he just seems at the top of his game right now, and just the speed, his speed and his efficiency at getting to positions is just amazing to watch at the moment.
Yeah, he's someone that looks like he is perfectly keyed into like everything that's in his tool bag, his, you know, exact like reach, his exact body type. He just feels like everything he's doing is exactly where it needs to be. I mean, by contrast, I think there are some wrestlers who have a tendency to, this is more, you know, this is personal soapbox, but, you know, want to do things that are maybe not perfect for their body type, or, you know, try to scramble when they're a shorter, stockier person, or, you know, try to muscle things when they're lankier. It feels like he's perfectly keyed into like his exact combo of like strength and lankiness. Everything that he's going for, he reaches it, but he's just has incredible athleticism and just speed. It's insane.
Yeah. I'm really excited to watch him at Worlds. It's going to be cool. I mean, I feel like every single match was a story, right? Like, I don't want to spend too much time on Final X stuff, 'cause that's not what our podcast is totally about. But I mean, Adeline Gray's story, interesting to see. Like, at literally every single match, I got stuff I'm thinking about. I mean, Burroughs not making the team again. And Marsteller looking even better since the last time he wrestled him. Scoring on him with more ease as well. I feel like last Final X, it was a lot more about, oh, Chance's strategy against Burroughs. And that was there this time. But also, Chance just looked like he was a better wrestler, like, throughout all three matches. And that's, like, that's a second weight class now that Burroughs is starting to get pushed out of.
Yeah, we'll see. you know, it could probably, it's probably the end of an era. I mean, it's tough to stomach, right?
Yeah, sad.
I mean, everything he's given, you'd like to see him go out Olympics, done, oh my god, you know, amazing, but it's looks pretty likely that this was the last one that he had in him, and he didn't make it, and next year it's going to be either 74 with Dake, or if he wants to try it, 86 with Taylor.
Yeah.
I don't see him winning either of those matches, so...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he says, hey, you know what, I'm done, right? I have a feeling that he'll still try to compete through the Olympics, and just kind of finish that out. And, you know, if he can't beat Dake, then, you know, that might be it for him. I mean, he has the ability to be a world team member for several more years. He is that good, right? Like, yeah. If Dake got hurt – you know, and he's the alternate, he steps in, like, he still has a chance to medal, right? He is still that good. It's just, you know, I do think he's lost a little bit of a step. And that's not, you know, that's like, you know, going from greatest of all time to one step slower than the greatest of all time of yourself, right? it's the tiniest bit, but it just really speaks to how good Dake has become, with, and having the youth factor, and Marsteller just really putting things together. Everyone knows about his story by now. And it's a good story. It's nice to see that. Like, we don't get a lot of, I mean, I don't mean just in wrestling, but, you know, people that have fentanyl addiction don't get very many, amazing comeback stories, right?
No, they don't.
Yeah, it's really good to see. It looks like he took himself from a really bad place to, you know, to being on top of the world in a sense, right?
I mean there was always an enormous amount of pressure there. There was always going to be sky high expectations. It was always, you know, I was at a Penn State camp when he was maybe a senior in high school, and you know, the whoever was teaching the camp that day was like talking about it. It's like, everyone know Chance Marsteller is? He's like, he's a high schooler who could probably win an NCAA title right now. And it's just the things that people said about him and what they built him up to be, you know, it's without a fentanyl addiction, without, you know, abuse and like everything he's been through, that would also break most people. Just the expectations alone.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know what? I'm glad he's where he's at, regardless of what, you know, his wrestling results are. I think it's cool. I think it's cool that he's made it this far. But not to dwell too much on Final X. We have our world teams. I'm excited to see it. Flo really shit the bed. We don't need to talk too much about that because it's all been.
Well, the great thing about Flo is you might not be able to watch it during the event, but you also can't watch it after the event either.
Yes, correct.
The website never works. You can't full screen half the time. It just stops buffering.
Yeah.
You can't find the matches.
The fact that I can't just type in a wrestler's name and it's like, here's their matches. Like, that's very silly. Like,
you type in a wrestler's name and you get an interview of them from when they were like 14 years old at Beast of the East.
Yes, I'm so glad that we paid money to fly people across the country so we can watch these 12-year-olds wrestle. That's definitely what I'm glad we're the subscriber money is going towards, as opposed to maybe a little bit more consistency with streaming. I don't know. That would just be fine and dandy. But anyway, the new rules came out, and for college wrestling, and the biggest, you know, controversial rule, I think, is probably the 3-point takedown. You and I are both pretty much in pro 3-point takedown camp. But, you know, I feel like there's a lot of, like, you know, fairly reasonable arguments that people are making against it. I don't agree with them, but, you know, I think the main one is that I see a lot is, well, now you can do a 7-point move. And if you get 2 7-point moves, that's only one move away from a tech. And I'm sitting here thinking, hell yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Hell yeah. What's the problem? Let's end this dang match. This guy's obviously destroying this guy. Let's not waste our time.
I have been beating this drum for years that the tech fall is unreasonably high in folk style.
Yeah.
And unreasonably low in freestyle.
Yeah. It really should be like 13 or something.
It really, 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And freestyle should just be 15. I mean, if we're okay with the tech being 15 in folk,
right,
there's no reason it shouldn't be high. It should be extremely rare in any case that someone comes back from being 1 point away from being teched.
Yeah.
And it never, ever happens in folk style. And it happens basically on a routine basis in free.
Well, and someone was saying, I was reading on Twitter, a guy was saying, well, now with these matches, you know, the really good wrestlers who get all those takedowns, like initially, they have a more of a cushion. So if a guy that's really scrappy wants to climb back, you know, he has to, you know, he has to hit, you know, take up more ground now. You know, the guy that might not be as good of a wrestler has to, it's harder for him to come back. And I'm like, good.
Good.
Like, the sport should be designed for the good wrestler to win. And also, if a guy is scrapping back, because those are great matches, now he has 3 points per takedown to do it with. It's easier to catch up, too. And I feel like,
I mean, there are a couple problems that I feel like we've seen with with folk style and, you know, with basically having a 1 point takedown differential in the vast majority of takedowns in close matches. One of the big problems was, like, a lot of times, you know, guys are in matches late because somebody might get 2 takedowns, whatever it is, it's like 4-2, 5-3 or something. And, you know, 1 takedown, they get a takedown, you know, they can tie it up. They're in the match. So there's a level of excitement that we might lose that is just from the possibility of that happening. But at the end of the day, like, most of it wasn't really happening. Most of the time, if someone was having, you know, that much more success on their feet, those matches, there was a possibility that they might come back. It was kind of interesting, but it usually never really happened. People stalled things out. I just don't see the point in, I mean, a takedown is, it's not 1 point. A takedown is not 1 point better than an escape. It's not 1 point as impressive as an escape. It's much more impressive. It's,
I mean, I think
three times as impressive.
Yeah. I think people like to make the argument that bottom is very difficult, especially at the college level. Like, it is not automatic that you're going to get an escape. You have to work hard for it. And I would say that might be true in a sense. I do still think that of all the ways in which you can score points, the escape is the easiest point to score, right? It doesn't mean that it's easy. Like, we understand that, but
yeah,
it is the easiest point to score.
I mean, the guys that can't get off bottom are usually also guys that can't get takedowns or can't turn.
Right.
I mean, usually if someone is having an enormous struggle on bottom, they're probably not getting a lot of takedowns. They're probably getting dominated in some sense. So in terms of like the fairness or whatever, I think it's better. But I guess the biggest thing here is just like, does it create a better product? And, you know, we just have all these prognostications from everyone on Twitter. They go like, wow, you know, this is terrible. Now that the takedown is 3 points, guys are going to be, it's like worse if you get taken down. If you shoot and you get taken down, that's like so much worse now, because now it's a 2 point differential. So obviously people are going to be more defensive, which is it. I don't know. It's an insane argument when you could also say it's also worth more. There's more of an incentive to get one.
Yeah.
It's one of these things where it's just all flying around. Everyone says, oh, this is what's going to happen.
But I mean, it doesn't change.
Nobody knows anything.
It doesn't even change the scenario though either, right? Like, if you have a 2 point takedown and an escape and you're up by one, you can't stall, because if the other person gets a takedown, then they'll be winning, right? How does that change when it's a 3 point takedown? 3 point takedown, you get a takedown, they get an escape. Now you're up by two. You still don't, like, it doesn't change the fact that if they score a point, they're going to tie you up again, right? It's not as much of an issue as people think it's going to be. Like, if I get 2 takedowns on someone in a match and it puts me up by 4 points, why would I stop doing that? Like, I understand the worry, like, well, that's a lot of points just to be able to stall out, but that's not a great way to, you know, that's not a great way to win a match, right?
I mean, if this was true, no one would ever get teched. No one would ever get majored.
Yeah.
Why would we even have those? If anytime someone was up on, you know, a lead that they thought was insurmountable, if they stalled, we would never have any majors. We'd never have any techs. People get majors and techs. Wrestlers wrestle.
Yeah.
It's what they do. They're going to go out with the new 3-point rules. Like, we're probably honestly, we're probably going to just see a lot more techs, probably going to make duels in some ways more exciting because, you know, the differentials are going to matter a little bit more.
Yeah.
It used to, I mean, there's so many situations where you have a guy who maybe is like top five in the country against someone who's outside of the top 20. And just if it's depending on the style matchup, you know, you can just put it in the bank that, like, you know, yeah, maybe we might end up with a 6 or 7 point differential, but very unlikely we get the major. And I just think, those duels might be a little bit more exciting now. Majors are easier to get. Like, that stuff actually is going to start mattering more.
And it's easier to save points too, right? Now, if you're, you know, if you're a guy who's losing by too much, right? And, you know, if you can get that one last 3 point takedown by the end of the match and save it from being a major, right? You can now do that. It's, you're right. It does make it a little bit more competitive. I think it does. But you're also right in that we just got to see it. We really got to see it because I feel like anytime we make major changes to rules, there's always like something that pops up. It's like, I did not expect that, you know, strategy or that loophole or whatever. So I'm also just interested in see what those things will be.
Yeah, I think my favorite part of the new rules is, you know, and people haven't been talking about this enough, but they changed the criteria on top for stalling to include anyone that is not working on top for, you know, a pinning combination. And I think that might have more, if it's reffed correctly,
exactly.
This might give the refs more cover to actually call stalling on top when it is there. Because, you know, it is by the letter of the law.
Yeah, I think that's the hope. And I think I'm glad that they're doing a change like this, where it is still allowing for the subjectivity of the call to be pretty present. Because I do want the referees to be able to make that subjective call of someone stalling, right?
Yeah.
But you're right. It's going to be like, are they going to execute on this? Are they going to call it? Are they going to call it well? Or is it going to just be like, well, now it's creating some other problem, right? So I do hope that it's going to just open up a little bit more aggression in terms of calling stalling on top, because it is sorely needed, especially if you're not going to get rid of writing time.
Yeah, the hope really is there that, you know, refs are clearly scared to call stalling. They, in their mind, clearly is, you know, too subjective at this point or too easy to argue that it isn't stalling. Hopefully this will make it a lot easier.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll be able to point to it and say, look, this is an obvious stall, obviously not working for a pin here. Hopefully this actually changes things. But I mean, that was, you know, 3 point takedown, 2 point takedown doesn't really matter to me, but I cannot watch Penn State sit on an ankle anymore.
Oh God.
It's getting very tiring.
Yeah. Oh, that ankle ride reminded me of something that I saw while watching some of the Turkish oil wrestling that we'll be talking about.
Oh, nice.
But right before we get into that, last episode, we were talking about the Olympic truce, where people aren't supposed to be at war during the Olympics. And I mentioned that it came back in like 94, 92, or whatever it was. We brought it back into the modern Olympics. And we were saying like, oh, how could it be that only Russia had been in violation of that, when we know the U.S. had been in all these other wars and other countries had been in wars, right? And I think I mentioned an example of Vietnam, which made no sense because Vietnam was over long before they reinstituted the truce. And it was bothering me when I reheard that, how silly that sounded. So I wanted to correct that really quickly. But that was all for our corrections and omissions for now.
Oh, that was another one for me. I said 100 yards when I meant 100 Greek feet. So the square that the Greeks wrestled in was not 100 yards long. It was 100 Greek feet long, which is pretty much analogous to our current feet. So
got it. Everyone at home right now is going, oh God, that was bothering me so much.
Yes.
I'm sure.
I can't believe it.
But last episode, you brought up the idea of us covering Turkish oil wrestling in this episode, and I'm glad you did. I had a lot of fun checking it out and learning a little bit more about it. It's one of those things that, you know, I'd seen like videos here or there of it and kind of like, oh, that's interesting, right? But never really like dove into it very much. And so this is going to be our first time covering a folk style. And I thought to get started, maybe we should talk about like, what do we mean by folk style? How would you define a folk style?
Basically, you know, like a vernacular style of wrestling that's local to one country. You know, it can be more, but it's like usually local to, you know, a certain place with certain customs, right? And it's just got its own, rule set, usually has its own, you know, their own style of attire, own rule set that's either, you know, very different from other styles, you know, or slightly different. But it does seem, you know, especially with the Greek and Turkish, kind of one thing we learned is that they were process that David Graeber and the other David who wrote that book, I don't want to leave him out of there, a term they coined in the book Dawn of Everything, schismogenesis, where they were basically talking about how cultures that are near each other develop along different lines because they are trying to be different. Mm-hmm. They're trying to be different than each other. They're trying to say, this is our style. We're different than you. You guys suck. and it seems like the Turkish, you know, the attire, the pants evolved from them wanting to wrestle like the Greeks, but not wanting to be naked.
So, yeah. And you brought that up in the previous episode, which kind of got us onto this, right? But yeah, so I kind of view, you know, folk styles as it is a style that is has like culture embedded with it, right? And I do think that this style of Turkish oil wrestling is a good example of that. And this is called, the actual style is called Yali Goresh, is how it's called, Yali Goresh. And there's a lot of interesting things about this style. And I do want to make sure that as we, you know, go through these styles, we want to make sure we're having some cultural sensitivity about us. I think that's responsible. And as I was doing some research on this, I found a journal, or excuse me, it was a handbook, and it's called The Handbook of Masculinity in Sports. So as we Turkish oil wrestling, as you can imagine, there's a lot of oil involved on two men and their bodies, right? And, you know, I think wrestlers in the United States are they're no strangers to be hearing things like, oh, wrestling is gay, right? And having this almost like homophobic kind of attitude projected towards you, right?
Yes, absolutely.
We're all very familiar with this. And so I found this journal that I thought was very interesting. And there was a chapter in it that says that was called Turkish Oil Wrestling and the Western Gaze. Hegemonic, heteronormative, Islamic body culture, and folk wrestling masculinities. And I thought this was really interesting. So we'll link this in the description, but I'm just going to read the abstract really quickly. As evidenced through its simultaneous development in disconnected societies, wrestling is the oldest and most basic form of human physical culture, fostering the primal desire for control. The discourse surrounding the sport of wrestling often draws on the symbolism of masculinity, struggle, strength, determination, courage, etc. The effects of time and distance led to the evolution of the regional variations witnessed today. One such variation in folk wrestling is Yagi Gures, oil wrestling, the national sport of Turkey. Through a Western heteronormative lens, the sport of oil wrestling, with its glistening and writhing bodies, does not perceptually coincide with the notion of, quote, compulsory heterosexuality. However, along with normalized platonic displays of same-sex affection, like hand-holding that we see in Islamic cultures, oil wrestling epitomizes masculinity in Turkish culture, which is misunderstood by and at odds with traditional Western conceptions of masculinity. The aim of this sociocultural study is to bridge the gap in Western understanding of Turkish oil wrestling through the examination of Islamic body culture, masculine symbolism in folk wrestling, and Turkish gender dynamics. So, big mouthful. But the big thing to take away from it, right, is we have certain kind of ideas of our gender roles here in the United States, right? And so when we see stuff in wrestling, well, let me put it this way. I was watching some footage and I was watching with my wife. And I didn't tell her anything about Turkish World Wrestling before we started watching it, right? And she started seeing some images and, you know, her response was, wow, that's gay. And she said, in a positive way, she's like, I actually like when sports are very gay. So that makes sense, right? But that's because her perception is very much about like what is gay, what is heterosexual, right? Is very much influenced by her upbringing and her nationality. And whereas, you know, in Turkey, the idea of men holding hands with each other, men rubbing each other down with oil, right? All kinds of this like very physical intimacy that is a little bit more acceptable and not seen in a manner that it's like it's signaling homosexuality, right? Sorry, I just said a whole lot.
Yeah, it's definitely something that when you watch it, you're going to, it's going to look different. It's, I don't know. I mean, it sort of calls into question the fact that, you know, really all of these, look, we're the woke wrestling podcast. I'm going to say it. Gender is fake. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, I feel like a lot of people might be listening and just saying like, okay, but what actually are you guys talking about? Like we're kind of alluding to things, right? So what does Yali Goresh look like? And it takes place. It just looks like wrestling. Honestly, it takes place on a big grass field. All the competitors come in. There's no weight classes. In fact, they like to say that one of the reasons for the oil is to make it so weight and strength advantages are less because it's harder to get a hold of people, harder to utilize your strength, right? However, I have to say the people that tend to kick butt at these tournaments are big, strong dudes. you know, you're not going to be surprised by who wins this stuff generally. And all the wrestlers, they all pair up and they go at it with each other at the same time. And this has a extremely old tradition. This was said to have started, it has its roots in ancient Sumer and Babylon. So going way back to, you know, what some would call cradle of civilization times, right? And they've been wrestling this style for a long, long time, all through the Ottoman Empire, where it really gained a lot of popularity. And right to today, it is a living sport. People are doing this, and they are doing it in like a big way. Like we said, it is Turkey's national sport of wrestling. But a really good way to kind of explore this sport is to concentrate on their one big event, and that's called the Kırkpınar. And it's held once a year in June. And every year there's about 1,000 competitors that come and they compete over 3 days. And this has been going on since around 1362. So that's 670 years of history. And wow. There have been times where they've skipped a year here and there, you know, for whatever reason. But it's been going on for a long time. It is the oldest living sporting competition. That's incredible. Like when I heard that, I immediately texted Sasha. I was like, this is so cool. I didn't even know this. I don't know. Did you even know about that beforehand?
No. I mean, the other funny thing, you know, about like, this is a very American thing, but like our oldest traditions are, you know, maybe things we got from Europe or whatever, so they can kind of count as old, but America's just a young country. Culture is so,
yeah,
young. I mean, something going on for that long, like an unbroken line of competitors that there's, you know, maybe we'll see later, decent amount of historical record on, is kind of crazy. You know, our oldest buildings are not very old.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've been doing this long. They've been longer than, you know, our country has existed. So it's kind of awesome.
Yeah, I really feel that, especially like living on the West Coast, right? There's a lot of like everything's new. right? Like the oldest stuff is like the missions and you know, maybe some cave dwelling areas, right? And none of it feels like it always feels like we have so much less history, which is a bad thing to think because of, you know, how rich indigenous culture was here. But we have a lot less, we know a lot less about that, right? So it's quite fascinating to see the recorded history in Europe quite a bit. But moving, so to continue the explanation, so the Kirkpinar, the wrestlers will come. It's a single elimination, just tournament bracketed style, and you keep going until there's a final winner, and the winner will receive a gold belt, and he gets to have that belt for a year. He brings it back the next year, and whoever wins the next year gets the belt. If you win 3 years in a row, then you get to keep your golden belt, and you're known as one of the coolest dudes, right? Everyone loves you. You walk through the streets. They follow you with drums and chanting, and everyone wants a picture with you. There's a dude that will help you wash off all your olive oil off of you. But the way the olive oil gets on the wrestlers to begin with is there's a pre-match ritual. Where the wrestlers will, you know, and people will help the wrestlers. They'll pour the olive oil all over their bodies. They will help each other. They'll rub each other down, help each other out. And they, you know, literally all over their bodies. They get it all over their bodies. They are wearing leather pants as they are during oil wrestling. And they have to get the oil down all over the pants, inside the pants, everywhere. And these pants are called the Kispet. And the Kispet originally was made out of heavy water buffalo leather that could weigh up to 13 kilograms. Just the pants, you know. That the art of making them is starting to get lost, actually. But more modern ones are made of calf skin, and they're much, much lighter. But this is the traditional kind of wear of the wrestler, or the pelvan, as they're called. They're called the pelvan. And so they're all wrestling at the same time. You lose. And how do you lose? Sasha, did you get a chance to look at the rules of how people lose in this?
No, but I'm going to guess what happens is, from my knowledge of these other folk styles, I'm going to go out on a crazy limb here and say probably it is when one person hits the ground with anything other than their feet.
You're very close. In fact, as I was watching this sport, I watched quite a few videos of it. It is incredible how much it looks like American folk style at times. So everyone is barefoot. You know, you're not allowed to kick people or hit people, eye pokes, biting. It's all the same rules that you would think of, right? For the most part, you know. And the way the match begins is they do this ceremony called the Peshrev, and it's kind of like they pace away from each other, they pace towards each other, they go to a knee, they say a prayer, they like touch their face and lips, and it is kind of like the prayer. And I guess some historians think that this ritual actually, although there's a lot of like Islamic aspects to the ritual, some believe that the actual ritual started before the Islamification of the area, like many, like a long time ago. Right. But so that's hard to really say. But these competitors, that's how they begin the match. And they go at it, you know, it just looks like folk style wrestling for the most part. Really, really big difference though, is, the way you win, right? Any turn, of the back to past 90, you win. Any turn, one turn, just has to face it.
A little bit like freestyle in that way.
So yeah, well, yeah, but it's not scoring. It's you win the match, period.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you pick someone up and walk a few steps with them, you win the match. Someone like, oh, you have injury defaults, you win, right? Things like that. And if you take someone from their feet and like land them on their butt, essentially, even if they don't expose their back, if they land on their hip or their butt, then you can win that way as well. And the idea being, you are not supposed to allow your belly to show to the stars, right? To the sky. It shows you're in a submissive position. And so that's, so the match is going to be very quick because it's just exposure, right? That's really all it is. Just exposure or just picking a dude up, right? So all that becomes a lot harder when everyone has a bunch of oil on them, right? And prior to 1975, the matches had no time limit. So matches could go on for days. And that made it really hard to commercialize things, right?
Yeah.
And, like, schedule things, right? So after 1975, it sure took several hundred years to get here, but they made it. They minimized the matches to 30 or 40 minutes, kind of depending on where, like, what tournament they're competing at. Usually someone wins within those 30 to 40 minutes if they, and then some tournaments they do an overtime where they do have scores, or they might do an overtime where you're trying to rip a band off of someone's ankle. But in general, the basic rules of lift someone, turn someone, throw somebody, those are all, the main ways people win. The big thing, like I said, when you watch it, it just looks a lot like folk style wrestling, but there's no stalling. Yeah. They're a lot of pressure on the head. It looks like they're really trying to tire people out. They're using the length of the match to their advantage if they can. But guys are really protective of their back. You see guys really turtle up, and then the other guy just kind of is on top of them trying to, a lot of times they take that chance to like rest on top and bottom, right? But the big difference that you're going to see that does not look like folk style wrestling is the wrestlers are allowed to take their hands and insert them into those leather pants, like all the way down to the elbow if they want. And they use this as a hold to create leverage in a way that, can kind of negate some of the slippery oilness. So I think I finally got to that aspect of it that people don't think about. You're not allowed to grab genitals. You're not allowed to insert anything anywhere. But yeah, you watch this and it'll look just like wrestling. It'll be hard to do ankle ride, Penn State ankle rides on people because they just slip their ankles right out of stuff because they're not wearing shoes. There's like things where it's just like, well, that technique will not work anymore. You'll see people with arms all the way down their pants trying to lift them up that way.
Yeah, and so are they working with these pants? Do they have any grips on the outside or on the inside, or are they just leather pants?
There's no grips, but they are baggy, so you can kind of get a handful, right? I would think of it more as like grabbing a gi, rather than grabbing something with a handle. That kind of what it reminds me of a little bit. There's not a ton to grab onto, but that's why they do it. You get your arm all the way through a pant leg. Now all of a sudden you can kind of flex it, make a fist, right? And like use that to leverage people up in the air. Because otherwise it's just hard to hold on to anybody.
Yeah, it's, it's tough. It's like, you're sweaty at the end of practice. You can't grab nothing. It's probably like that times 100. Yeah. One thing I'm seeing a lot of, as far as techniques go, it does look a lot like, it looks a little bit like, folk style, right? There's just like a lot of top bottom, same kind of, referee's position on bottom. But something I'm finding interesting is sort of like wrestling, crotch lift sort of exposure that they're going for.
Yeah.
But with, sticking their hands all the way through the pants.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of because of all the oil, it makes sense. Like when I'm watching them on their feet, I'm thinking, okay, what would I do here? Because like everything just slips out of any grip, right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to control an ankle. It's hard to control a knee. If I'm trying to get in, maybe I'm thinking standing single, bring the lock right into the crotch and do like more of a lift, right? And try to score where you're lifting and walking for a few steps, like get the win that way. But you can't elbow pass. You can kind of collar tie a little bit, but especially on your inside ties or your elbow ties, it's all that stuff is just, it disappears with how much oil is involved. Yeah, like how kind of the difference between when you have a, you're on an ankle in wrestling and you can kind of lock it in because he's wearing a shoe, right? And then you try to do that in BJJ and it's like, oh, not quite as easy, right? It slips out a lot easier. Now imagine he's covered in oil, right? And a lot of, I think a lot of bread and butter style single leg attacks kind of go away in this, right? But I do see double legs. I understand that. I do see just kind of like knee pick style stuff maybe. But you've got to like really control a joint if you're going to control a joint. Like how are you, like, you know, maybe some duck under stuff I could see, maybe that. But anything where you're trying to like kind of suck something in, just it's, that's going to be tough.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a lot of the, when you're watching this, are we seeing more takedowns from standing? Or are we seeing more of, you know, are people getting, it seems to me like the goal here would be try to get on top and then work some sort of crotch lift or something like that for the exposure. It seems like getting, you know, takedown straight to that back is going to be really hard.
Yeah, I think, and a lot of the top work that you would normally have in like in folk style, it just doesn't, it's not going to be there, right? You can't run a wing, right? People just slip right out. Yeah. You can't run like a half, like they're going to crunch down the half and everything's just going to slide off. Right. So it's probably, you can't gut wrench either, right? It's going to slip. So yeah, the crotch lift stuff or getting your hand in the pants so that you can lift them by it are the really only realistic options that I'm seeing. I did see a lot of guys kind of do a hooking the elbow on a cow catcher, that kind of thing, and try to like wrench people over that way. I saw a little bit of that, so I could see that seemed to be something that people found success with. But yeah, the only takedowns I saw that really were effective in getting a win, like taking people through to their back, were double legs. Everything else was just, some guy's in a shot, the guy sprawls, gets behind, maybe there's a peek out here or there.
Yeah.
But it was just like, it's like a bunch of Jaden Coxes all trying to wrestle each other.
You got to wipe them down. You got to wipe them down.
But they're more tired. They're even more tired. Yeah, that was one thing I would say. These guys look tired from minute one. Like the whole match, they look tired. But they're that's like, probably just because they're trying to conserve. Rahalis. What's that?
They're like Eric Rahalis. They're coming into the stadium tired.
Yeah, right. But you know, I'm sure they're just trying to conserve for like a freaking 40-minute match, right?
Yeah, that's insane.
That's wild.
So if we're talking, it's 1K competitors, right? It's all one bracket.
All one bracket, and they do it over 3 days. So you got heats, right? So as soon as everyone, you know, wins or loses a match, it can't be longer than, you know, whatever it is, the 40-minute time limit, you know, then they'll probably get another heat going.
Yeah, so if you want to win this, bracket. It looks like you're going to have... Did the math. It's about nine or 10 matches.
Per day or total over 3 days?
Total. If you're saying it's a 1,000 person bracket, everyone's, you know, starting there.
Yeah.
That works out to, divide that by two, nine times.
Nine over 3 days.
That's already one thing when you're doing, you know, NCAA wrestlers, you know, four or five matches, depending on the backside, you know, seven ish, I think. Right. Probably something like that.
Yeah.
But that's like 7-minute folk style matches over the course of 3 days.
Well, and imagine if you get like a tough guy early and you spend 40 minutes wrestling and your next opponent, you know, later that afternoon, like just freaking mauled his guy.
Yeah.
And now it's like one guy's really fresh and the other guy had already wrestled for 40 minutes, like literally.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, another thing I saw, if you, at any point, if a wrestler wants to add more oil, they may. So if they're like, my dude needs some more oil over here. Hold on, let me get you, bro. Let me get you. He goes over, and they're little like watering cans, like you'd water like flowers with, right? Yeah. That's what they pour the oil on people with. And like, there you go. And they're so friendly with each other. They're like very like into touching each other, right? Like, and I think that's something I notice with American wrestlers as well, right? We're a little bit more okay with grabbing onto each other, right? Like, yeah. We get in the room, so, you know, I say hello to people with a Russian tie, you know, it's something that we do, right? So I see why they do, right? Like it's, they're just all into it. And then they can also pause the match if both wrestlers agree that they would like to wash some oil out of their eyes. So that's a fair rule, I think.
Yeah. It seems like a good way to keep things going.
Yeah. But the imagery of it is, imagine a joust. That's what it feels like. It's like a big kind of grassy area. That's kind of, it could be more of a square, or more of like a rectangle. People are in stands that are kind of elevated, really close. And it reminds me of one of those like old medieval arenas in some of these images that I've seen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then 100%.
And then it's like a high school wrestling scrimmage there, like where everyone's there and you have like 20 referees all trying to keep people from running into each other,
yeah.
and stuff like that.
The refs have a pretty great fit.
What's that?
The refs have a pretty great fit. They're looking pretty cool.
Yeah. And they're not just like referees. They're also kind of like the masters of ceremony too. They kind of like lead people through the rituals that they do before and after. But yeah, like it looks like a fun time. Like I would definitely go to this and watch this. Like this was really cool to see. And you know, I feel like if they use less oil, they could do more moves and they might enjoy that. I would encourage that for them. But at the same time, you know, I'm glad they got That's their own thing going on. It's really neat to me.
Yeah, it definitely seems like a great event. Something that, yeah, just really, I mean, like steeped in like so much history. It's crazy.
Yeah. Can you imagine like, I guess like the way the tournament gets sponsored is like just rich people just put up money for it too. And I'm not exactly sure like what happens with the money. I think they like the winners, and like second place, third place, I think they all get different prizes. But yeah, I will say like it looked like a really healthy, positive culture, like around things. Like people were like pretty cool and chummy with each other. It felt like people had a good time with it. It was definitely like one of those moments where maybe you go like traveling somewhere and you kind of witness a cultural event that you're not familiar with, but you still kind of feel like, oh, this is like I feel the community happening, right? That's kind of what it felt like when I watched a lot of these.
Yeah. So do you know if there's any way that we could spectate this?
Like watch it live?
Have you been able to find any information on if we wanted to watch, what is the yearly tournament called again?
What is it called? Kirk Pinar.
Yeah, do you have any clue on how we could watch Kirk Pinar?
That's a good question. It might have already happened.
Can we gamble on this?
It might have already happened, but we could actually. I didn't even think about that because you're right. I even said that it happens like around June. We should. I don't know. I did not look that up. That's a good idea. We should do that. future fun for thought, or food for thought. Fun food for thought. I apologize to any listeners if I sound weird. I definitely got a little bit more intoxicated before doing this podcast than I normally do, but it's okay. It was a fun day.
I took a very long nap, so this is kind of the sleepy episode.
Sleepy cast. But that about wraps it up for the wonderful world of Yali Goresh and the Kisbet and the Kirk Pinar and the Pelavons. and all the cool stuff that we learned about with Turkish oil wrestling. Really, really neat. Can't wait to do the next little cultural exploration. But before we get to that, I will be the first to admit that I can be an argumentative person. And I've definitely felt that way recently with some people's takes, some cultural and historical revisionism going on in the wrestling world. And you know what? I blame MMA fans. You know, they don't make it easier. But some people seem to be under the impression lately that Brock Lesnar's wrestling career is worth ogling at a little bit too much.
I knew this was going to come up.
And I've got to say, what I am not saying is Brock Lesnar is a bad wrestler. I am not saying that. I am not saying that Brock Lesnar is a bad athlete. I am definitely not saying that. Here's what I will say. Brock Lesnar was a fun wrestler to watch. He was incredibly strong, and he used that to his advantage. But I think people making the claim that Brock Lesnar is just as good as the best modern college heavyweights is gravely mistaken. Here's how I'll illustrate that. If you go on YouTube and look up Brock Lesnar college wrestling highlights, you will not find very many videos. You will find the longest video you will find is a minute and 50 seconds. And every single clip is from like three different matches where he was lifting up a guy in the air because he's very strong and putting him down and getting a pin. And that's good. That's good that Brock Lesnar can do that. He's a, he's an awesome wrestler. And it's really cool that he went from junior college, and became a two-time national finalist. But when I watch tape of Brock Lesnar wrestling, I look at a guy who is doing his best to have really good defense and looking for his opportunity. When I compare him to modern heavyweights like Gable or Paris or literally anybody in this NCAA wrestling class, he would not AA. I don't know if he would AA. I don't think he would have very many opportunities to AA within the last 5 to 10 years. Like, I don't think he is quite the athlete that some people might think he is when in wrestling specifically, right? If you look back, you see he wins impressive matches against guys who he can physically bully. But anytime he wrestled anybody good, he was into stalling, he would play the edge, and he would not score any points offensively. There would be escapes, things like that. And case in point, I would invite anybody to watch his two NCAA finals. The one in which he won, I believe he won 3-2 or something like that, all escape points, and had to rely
on... All escape points?
And I think he had to rely on overtime rules to get the win. And previous to that, he wrestled Stephen Neal the previous year. And hey, I don't blame anybody for losing to Stephen Neal, but Brock Lesnar didn't make it look very competitive. He made it look close because of how he played the game. And yeah, that's a part of wrestling too. He understanding your abilities and using strategy is part of being a good wrestler.
For a right. guy is enormously strong, like the way people talk about him, like it was insane, he was incredible. A dude who, you know, if he had the technique, if he had the, you know, with that body, with that strength, if we just gave him the technique of like Lucas Davison,
yeah,
would be an entirely entirely more dominant wrestler.
And even then, I don't know if he would beat Gable.
Oh, of course not. It's the stupidest thing ever. It's so stupid. Get the fuck out of here.
Dude, yeah. Okay,
let's take a look at this year. So this year's All-Americans at heavyweight.
Let's go down the line.
Let's go down the line. Mason Paris
destroys him.
It's not happening. Yeah. Mason wins that. I mean,
Mason trips him with a foot sweep.
Greg Kirkfleet.
Greg Kirkfleet destroys him.
Absolutely. this is a fun one. Wyatt Hendrickson
beats him.
That's no just question. A better Brock Lesnar.
Hendrickson could hold position for the first 3 minutes of the match, and then Brock Lesnar will be very tired, and Wyatt Hendrickson would destroy him. I don't even know if Brock Lesnar would get an escape on Wyatt Hendrickson.
No, I mean, Wyatt, if you like really think about it, it's like Wyatt Hendrickson kind of is just a better in terms of like he is clearly the strongest person in NCAA wrestling currently.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's just an absolute freak of nature. He couldn't beat Greg or Mason. And I agree. I think he would absolutely destroy Brock Lesnar. Tony Cassiope.
See, now this one I'm less certain about. And I think is a stylistic matchup, right? Because Lesnar just shells up. And I think Cassiope needs people to open up a little bit more on him. So I don't know, but I could see it go either way. I think Brock has a better chance in this one, but I still think Cassiope would get it.
I think if we're time traveling Brock Lesnar, if we're teleporting him through time to wrestle Cassiope, I think Cassiope takes it on some sort of scramble that Brock Lesnar was not ready for.
Yeah.
Probably just didn't. Okay. Here, probably just would not be ready for. Okay, here's where I think we're getting to the, we're these are some good, maybe some better matchups for Lesnar. Lucas Davison.
I see Lesnar really being able to out-muscle him. When I look at the old tapes of him, he might be able to out-muscle Lucas Davison pretty good. But I wouldn't count Luke out.
No, absolutely not. But it could be, I could see him winning, yeah. I could see him winning that one like 2-1 or something.
Yeah.
3-2.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly. Like if he plays good strategy.
Okay, Zach Elam.
See, I think Elam would beat him. I think he's too athletic. You think Elam would beat him? I think he's too athletic for him. I think he'd be too fast.
Yeah, he is. But that's a thing. Is it like is he too small? Or
well, that's, you know, like, even someone to... like Trent Hilger, right? Like, Trent Hilger is, like, really athletic and can move well for a heavyweight, yeah. Right? But it's hard for him to beat bigger dudes sometimes, right? But okay, Colton Schultz. Yeah, I don't know. Oh, Colton Schultz?
Yeah, our seventh and eighth placers for this year, Colton Schultz and Trent Hilger.
I would just love to see Colton Schultz throw Lesnar. That would be amazing. I think he would. I think he would throw Lesnar.
I think he would too. He's so, you know, he's so big. Lesnar not going to be able to move him that easily. I absolutely think Colton Schultz would take that match.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, and
especially when he's healthy.
And we could keep going like back into like, there's so many older heavyweights that like, I don't even think would be very competitive. Like Tony Nelson. Right, Tony Nelson, I think, would beat Brock Lesnar. Right, there. Like,
oh yeah,
I feel like there's so many heavyweights I can think of that we can pull that would just be like, no. So, I had to get that off my chest a little bit because, like, I don't want to take anything away from Brock Lesnar from what he's done, but I want people to have a better, more realistic understanding of what type of wrestler he was, like the quality of his wrestling.
Yeah, they look at his physique and they go, wow, it's incredible. He must have been so dominant. And he wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I think, because I watched one of his matches from when he was in junior college. It was rough. Like there was some... like really not great at moving his feet in a lot of ways, right? Like it looked very like robotic, right? I think he can get that way. He gets like really robotic with where he places his feet and trying to move around. And it doesn't look very athletic. It looked bad. But what you see from his jump from there to when he's at Minnesota is a much more refined mind game, right? And just kind of understanding like where his strengths were, when to use them, And they definitely made him a better wrestler pretty quickly just by switching his behaviors on the mat, which was good. Showed that he was really coachable and knew how to adjust that. So yeah, once again, I'm not trying to Brock Lesnar, as I'm sure you're listening. you know, we don't need to, you know, react in any violent ways about this. But as I'm sure you'll love to come on the podcast later on, and we would love to have you. You have a right to respond, Mr. Lesnar. You have a right to respond. You can, or your attorney, if you would like to speak through them, that is okay as well. We'll make sure that you have our email in the description.
Absolutely. Lesnar, we want to see you. We want to see you.
Well, that's about it for today. I guess the last thing before we really sign off is, what do we want our next episode to do?
You know, if we want to stay with big football field, big old football style field full of dudes just wrestling, then we'll go to Mongolia. If we want to hit something different, something entirely new, I don't know.
I will say something going on right now is sumo is getting some swell. I think there's a Netflix show coming out on some sumo guys. There's a lot of new things happening in sumo. I could see us doing that.
We could do multiple episodes, I'm sure, on sumo.
We might have to. There's a lot to break down. Like I was looking into that a little bit more too, and was just kind of fascinated with like the stuff that's going on that's controversial in the sport right now. But probably shouldn't get too much into it until the episode. But I'm very I would see that. I'm still down to do a movie review. I think that would be fun. I will say I do not want to do Vision Quest first.
No, we're not. We can't do Vision Quest.
Not first. We would eventually have to. but we don't need to do it right now.
Movie review could be good. And I have 4 days off. I'm going to be working a 50-hour week this week. Then I'm going to have 4 days off. Then I'm going to work for 2 days. Then I'm going to work for 3 days.
Okay. You got a lot of variety.
Yeah, the school system has a lot of holidays. So
here's what I'll say. What would you say about doing Foxcatcher?
That'd be fun. It's a little more historical. The
Steve Carell one, right?
Get into RTCs and some of the stuff where some of the new changes in our sport. I think that could be fun.
We could talk about that. I see those parallels. But I think that we could talk about that. I think what would also be good for us to do is come up with a system of how we want to evaluate these films, right?
Yeah.
So if we want to do wrestling films, I think, you know, there might be some tiers, right? There's a tier of like, these are films that are about wrestling. And there might be a tier where like, these are films that include wrestling in them.
Right? Yeah.
And then you might have another tier where it's like, this isn't about wrestling really, but it's tangential and maybe it mentions wrestling or maybe there's a wrestler involved, right? Things like that. So I think we'd have different tiers, but I think it'd be cool if we figure out how are we evaluating this film? Like, are we like on its production, on its representation of wrestling? Like, what do we want that to be? I think that'd be fun to establish.
That would be fun. Yeah, I think we can figure out a little criteria. I think Foxcatcher would be a good one.
Okay. So you want to do that? Let's do a movie.
Yeah.
Sick. All right. That'll be good. We'll watch Foxcatcher. I'll take some notes.
Okay.
So we can move through it. And I'm going to complain. I'm going to complain about some stuff that I think will be funny. we might have to talk about Mark Schultz.
100% we're going
to talk about Mark Schultz. And Mark, I know you're listening. You and Brock are sitting on the couch together. You just enjoyed your platonic dinner together and talking about your investments and your feelings and about, you know, the things that you might regret in life or the things that you're proud of. and you both sat down with a glass of wine to listen to your favorite podcast, and we talked about both of you. You know, we just want you both to know that our door is open. Anyway, yeah, we'll talk about Foxcatcher next time.
All right, let's do it.
All right, folks, have a good one.
Okay, wait, we're done.